This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 368 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Courtney G. And not to forget, we still have a few spots left on our Pod Abroad 2021 tour. You can find out more at podabroad.com.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we will be continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along with chapter 38, entitled The Deal in the Milk.
Yes, A Deal in the Milk.
That's a weird, it's a weird letter to leave out of all the letters in that word. I feel like that's an important letter, a V. We all know it's saying devil, but that's not the letter I'd leave out. I'd leave out maybe the E or the I. I think you could still get it with one of those letters missing. That's all I'm saying.
So we have Henri Christian. Meaning he's born, he's part of the family now, and it's raining outside and there's laundry to do. And I didn't write it until later on, I think toward the end of the chapter, but this is one of those chapters, even though kind of scary stuff is discussed in the chapter or sad, you know, kind of not so fun stuff, it still has a Lallybroch type feel to it in that for the moment, they are safely ensconced inside. It's cold and wet and rainy outside, and they're inside with the fire, and it's a little, you know, it's a little, probably a little dewy, moist, whatever, because of all the laundry they have that they can't hang outside because it's raining. But they have kids and they're playing and talking about, you know, and a little baby and nursing and doing and sewing or not sewing, spinning. So it just, it's a very Lallybroch like moment to me, as far as it's very like a homey cozy ish. And so even though that is the case, I wonder when they're doing laundry, I think of having to hang laundry. Now I typically use my dryer for all bedding, all towels, sheets, everything like that. Towels, sheets, anything cleaning that you either use to clean or that you know comes into contact with your body and all that kind of stuff. But clothing, even though that comes into contact with your body, clothing, I do wash, use a washer, but I hang almost everything. Do you have a way you do things or a way you, like a preference when it comes to that?
I use a dryer.
For everything?
I use a dryer.
So for everything, including bras, underwear?
Yeah. I mean, bras are different. Bras don't go in the dryer. That's just because I don't want them to die a horrible death before their time. But the rest of my clothes, absolutely. Dryer. Dryer on low.
Do you do everything? Or are you like me, where you don't do any clothing in the... I wear clothing. But you don't put any clothing in the dryer?
Not at night, you don't.
Or do you have like certain things, like your own family's traditions or your own practice or preference that, you know, you only do certain things or you only do it like once a year? I don't know. So if you guys have interesting preferences, I'm always curious about things like that, because as you can see, we were raised in the exact same home and we're different in that respect. So it's annoying. I will say this. Like I said, I hang things, right? Clothing. And I do find it annoying. Now, even when it's quite warm or hot here, I don't typically hang things outside currently. I could on my patio, but it's a bit of a pain to block the cats, open the door, because I have two big, sliding glass door. It's a bit of a pain to move everything outside and not get it dirty and not have it fall, whatever. But the trade-off is I have to hang it inside, which is fine. But so whether it's winter or summer, I typically hang indoors. But if I hang indoors, then I have my cats. I mean, I always have my cats, but one of my cats specifically climbs on the big thingy that you put out, like you you unfold it and hook it or whatever it is to like to put things over, like a drying rack, I guess. She climbs on that and it falls. So it, no matter what I do, I have, there's always something, but that's, I guess, a strike against the cats. I'll never get rid of them. That's, I guess, another reason for you not to dry on a rack, because you have a dog as well. And that might not be pretty.
I mean, I can't believe we're going into laundry right now. But my issue is not, my issue is not with how they dry. It's that the second they come out of the dryer, no matter what I do, there's instantly white colored fur on everything.
That's true. I don't have dark, dark cats. I have Torties, but they, you will get, depending on the color you wear, you'll get either a dark hair, so almost like a black, or like an orange hair. That's all that shows up, is the orange on something or the black on something light. So they're doing laundry. That's one of the things they're doing. So Marsali is loving the spinning wheel that Bree has made. She said she, Brianna did, she says she, quote, saw one somewhere, unquote. And we learned that this is true. She had seen it in a folk art museum. And Marsali takes to it like the pro that she is. Meanwhile, the cozy scene with the fam bam includes Roger whittling another vroom. It's his own fault, because once word got out that he'd made one, all the kids wanted one.
His vrooms being all the kids to the yard.
Yes, Summer, yes. So now that the Ridge Goblins all have vocabulary, including truck, which is a vroom, just a big one. And I said Ridge Goblins, but it's not just the goblins, right? Because the goblins are the ones who were the original dwellers. So anyway, at Bree's suggestion, Roger lays out the racetrack, a racetrack, in chalk, and for the kids to race their vrooms on. We find out there that Germain is with Fergus, and Fergus is, or has been, off fighting with people, basically. He's been gone for a bit. He's been defending the honor of his family ever since Henri Christian's birth. So people asking him things such as, why didn't you just strangle him at birth? And some others think that the baby is the devil's seed. Quote, I think they'd burn the wee man and me and the other weeans along with him if they thought they could, unquote. That's Marsali. So apparently Jamie had been out and about speaking with people, and he'd apparently had some effect on the wee fam and their safety. So him being out loud and proud about, you know, the baby, Marsali, Fergus and everything definitely affects their level of safety. Marsali takes to feeding the baby. They're in their little Lallybroch moment. And Brianna starts spinning. And now we get to see inside her head. So the birth of a dwarf had sent shockwaves through the ridge, of course. People were connecting, as people of the time, superstitious, having a lack of entertainment, right? People of that time were understandably connecting recent events, like the assaults on Marsali and Claire, the burning of the malting shed, the kidnapping of Claire, the slaughter of her captors in the woods, with this birth. The word witchcraft was being murmured. And of course, some of the new tenants, especially the non-goblins, were afraid of Claire, more so than Jamie. But this changed with the birth of Henri Christian. So these people are connecting. These people who are new and thus don't know Claire, or don't know the Ridge Goblins very well, right? And Claire, of course, remember when they came up that hill or down that hill, whatever it is, and they saw their first glimpse of Claire and Bree was them in their shifts, curdled up to their above their knees with something in their hand. I forget what, but they were running around fanning the flames of this field so that they could kill all the locusts, but there was another word for them. The animals that little insects that had been driven, they drove the insects to this field so they could kill them. And so here they are, like basically half naked women dancing around a fire. And these very, very devout Protestants come over the ridge and they see the wife of their ridge, of their ridge, not master, but their the owner. So she started off on a bad leg, right? It didn't start off well. And so now, and then all these things happen, which, you know, sad, too bad, so sad, not good things. And then her daughter from another, her non-blood daughter, gives birth to a dwarf. So they're putting not only all these recent events connecting them to the birth of Henri Christian, they're making a much stronger, and going back a little bit more, to connect it with, you know what? We were afraid of Claire, but now it's like, no, she's not someone, you know, she's bad. If they were on the fence before, it's no longer that way.
I would have just blamed Brownsville.
Oh, that's funny. How do you blame Brownsville for the dwarf?
Because they beat her. They don't know what happens inside of a pregnant lady. They're not smart enough to know better. For all they know, being injured at all while pregnant could affect your child in that way. Even that close to term. I'm just saying. That's better than... I prefer them blaming people at Brownsville than them thinking that I had sex with a devil. I'm just saying. I'm like... If you have to physically blame a person, blame the people that hit her in the head and made her unconscious while she was heavily pregnant.
I get it. So as for Fergus, he had taken off when the baby had been born for several days. And she thinks how thankful she is that Jemmy, again, we're in Bree's head. She thinks how thankful she is that Jemmy was born without defect or defect, both either. In this time especially, and how it could happen at any time to anyone. We learn that she'd begun to take her, I'm guessing it's pronounced Dako or Dauko seeds, presumably for contraception, since she hadn't told Roger that she'd been taking the seeds yet. So it has even affected her wanting a child just right now, right? Not to take any chances just right now. And... at this moment, someone is pounding at the door of the cabin. It's Wee Aiden, one of the fisher folk, aka the non-goblins, for the minister. And of course, that would be Roger. And why is he wanted? Quote, Mither says, will you come, please, for to drive out a deal what's got into the milk. Yeah, we're not great at reading Scots. So a little history of the McCallum fam. They were newcomers. Orem, the man, father, husband of the family, had, quote, managed to erect the walls of his shakily built cabin and then had missed his footing and plunged into a rock-strewn ravine, breaking his neck within a month of arrival on the ridge and leaving his pregnant wife and young son to its dubious shelter. Ooh, that's a lot for that woman to have to go through, right? Not just moving with her family.
That would suck. That would suck hard.
Donkey balls.
Like...
big ball.
Hard. Like, I'm just bigger than that, Ginger. However big you think they're going to be, they're bigger. Bigger. I'm just saying, it's like you leave everything, you have nothing, and as a woman, you can't own anything, and you can't work for your money in a respectable way, and then your one money holder, or your the person who helps to support the family is dead within a however long of joining them there in the United States. Boo. Sorry. Colonies.
And he leaves her pregnant, which obviously is a stress. And even though he leaves her with the shelter, it's flimsy as a hail. So it's not worth much. Poor dude. He can't even leave her one thing. Well, he left her a baby. That's one thing.
He clearly wasn't done. I mean, come on. He wasn't done.
So others had helped put the roof on, but it was flimsy. And she says she knows that he, Roger, is not a minister, but that his dad was. So, dot, dot, dot. It was Lizzie Weems had brought a pail of milk to the cabin the day before for Aiden and herself to drink. It had been from Claire. Now, herself, Aiden's mom, wasn't too keen to drink it, but her son would.
I wouldn't drink it. And I know it's not a devil, but I wouldn't drink it.
So she wasn't too keen, but she said her son would drink it. But when she went to get some, it moved. When she went to get some, something moved. And so thus she thought it was haunted. So what follows is an action scene with a milky frog. And no, I did not do the point by point. There's no point.
It's definitely possessed.
Very much so. By the end of it, the mother is sitting on the floor and is having a fit under her apron. She ends up saying, Why? And this is very touching. No, it makes, I really do feel bad for her. Why has God brought me here? So I understand this and her sadness, being in a new country, left a young pregnant widow, and Roger is trying to comfort her. She says she misses the sea, and he really can't say anything much about that because the likelihood is she won't ever see it again, but he does promise that he won't let them starve.
Then she should drink the milk because I bet it's pretty fishy.
Oh, that's gross. He gets her up to feed the baby while he cleans the flimsy shack. So after this, he had decided he was going to talk to Jamie and to others to see that the young family would be provided for with food. And as he's walking home, he sees Aiden out fishing and talks to him. And that's all we get there.
Do you know what's so frustrating about what comes from that? The whole statement of everyone on the ridge is willing to share, but only if you ask. Like, you clearly can see this woman struggling, but unless she, like, prostrates herself to you, or prostrates herself to you, you have all the things that you would have in either way, right? So whether she asks you or not, but you're only willing to share them when she prostrates herself to you and admits that she needs help. Like, that, to me, was just like, come on. The ridge ain't that great of a place if you're not going to try to anticipate when people are hurting and need help.
The sentiment that you just said, that you shared, absolutely bothered me too. I picked up on that. I just didn't write that down. The only thing that makes sense, in case we're not understanding it correctly, because we may be, we probably are. The only thing that made sense was because people on the ridge, now they know each other's business, right? Because they're all right there. But some of those homesteads are pretty far apart. So you don't see everybody every day, you probably do see them at least once a month, right? Just by running into them wherever you're going.
You're right. But they also don't have much to do for entertainment, which means they're all talking to each other. So the people have to be close enough that at least one of those families has to walk by that house to get to some of the other places they're going. Like, the odds of this one household being so far on the outskirts, and they helped her build her house after her husband died. So they knew she was struggling.
They knew she was a widow. Exactly. So I'm surprised that it took until this point, Milk Devil, mm-hmm. What did she think? What did they think was going to happen? She was suddenly going to become a hunter? I mean, as soon as he died and they had him in the ground, they should have had this plan.
Exactly. Especially since the extent of their plan was to help finish her house. That was it. Okay, you have a flimsy roof. You're good. You can do all the things now. Oh, I'm sorry. You're about to pop a baby out of your V. Whatever. You'll be fine. Your infant or your toddler child can clearly hunt and fish and farm for you.
Go fish and everything for you. Yeah. So scene change. It is now All Hallows Eve. They, whoever we're with, wake up on All Saints and there is snow. So the description here in the final few paragraphs of this chapter close up a Lally Brock like, of course, okay, not the milk frog.
No, but it's a respite. It's definitely a respite from the craziness that these books.
Yes. So these paragraphs close up the Lally Brock-like scene, which was from earlier, also wrap up safety that the family feels, if only for a blink.
And it wraps up October of 1773.
That is true. So Maria R. writes, this chapter opens with the celebration of Brianna's engineering prowess by building a spinning wheel for Marsali's use, of which she is quite grateful. This also leads to a discussion of talk on the ridge regarding ill luck that is being attached to the birth of wee Henri Christian. The deep-seated superstitions of their neighbors are ever present throughout this chapter. We see Roger's sincere ministerial tendencies put to work as well. It is also the beginning of his platonic, but also suspicious, to others, relationship with Amy McCollum, a young widow. Amy requests Roger exorcise the milk from what turns out to be a mischievous boy, her son, placing a frog in the milk. His mother, however, reacts with hair-raising fear to this haunting. And so from exorcism to witch trials, the supernatural theme and superstitious fears of people of the mid-18th century continue to be strongly present throughout Diana's writing.
And that was chapter 38.
With HelloFresh, you get fresh, pre-measured ingredients and mouth-watering seasonal recipes delivered right to your door. HelloFresh lets you skip those trips to the grocery store and makes home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. That's why it's America's number one meal kit.
HelloFresh offers convenient, contact-free delivery right to your doorstep for easy home cooking with the family.
There's something for everyone, including weekly low-calorie, vegetarian, and family-friendly recipes.
HelloFresh has already donated over 4 million meals to charity in 2020, and now they're stepping up food donations to local communities amid the food insecurity crisis and pandemic.
I've had the chance to recently try out some vegetarian HelloFresh meals, and I have had a chance to actually create or cook two of those meals, and that was the silky Sicilian penne and the barbecue pineapple flatbreads. So one of the things I love about HelloFresh is that, you know, it comes with all the ingredients. It has pictures of each. It has a picture of each ingredient on the one side with a back and front one sheet. And on one side, they have the name of the recipe or the meal. And then they have like a picture of what it should look like at the end, pictured with all the individual ingredients. And on the other side, they have step-by-step instructions and pictures that go along with each step. So it's not that I've never cooked. It's that I don't frequently cook from scratch this much. And so I found it not only fun to, you know, cook more, but also it was a great opportunity to catch up on some of my favorite podcasts, right? Or you can have a TV show going, or you can be talking with someone on the phone, you know, with a speaker or something. It takes some of the planning or most of the planning out of it. And it's for someone, especially who doesn't do a lot of cooking, it makes everything easy to arrange and organize and follow.
Go to HelloFresh.com/Outlander10 and use code Outlander10 for 10 free meals, including free shipping.
That's right. Use code Outlander10 for 10 free meals, including free shipping. Go to HelloFresh.com/Outlander10.
America's number one meal kit.
We're going to continue with chapter 39, entitled I Am the Resurrection. And what I want to say about this chapter before you start, Ginger, is that this is one of those chapters that when I was reading it, I remembered it, but it's not vital to the main plot of the story. So it's kind of like it's a Lallybroch chapter in a different way.
Okay. The fact that you said that, you are not wrong in that the things that happen in here are...
They're episodic and not part of the arc of the season. You know what I mean?
It's not vital, but there are certain things in here that are connected to later vital things. I won't say what those later things are, but the things from this chapter would be, it's a way, and I put this in my notes, it's a vehicle Diana uses to introduce us to the myth, legend, superstition, whatever, of the graveyard and the and who haunts it. So that's in this chapter. It also sets us up for, not that we need to know what the person is or what this person is later on as far as their role, but it introduces a character of the sin eater.
Other than that, everything leading up to the impromptu wake, literally, was fine. Like, you could have all of those things happen and it wouldn't be a big deal. But everything that happened between the actual wake and the end of the chapter, like, that whole instance was not really necessary. I mean, it was funny and it was clever and it was entertaining and I enjoyed reading it. But none of those things were vital. You didn't need this chapter, all of this chapter, I should say, to enjoy the rest of this book. It is not important to the arc of the season or the arc of this book. It is just kind of a little side venture that, you know, feeds some other things in the interim, but it is not vital to the arc of the book, is what I'm saying. Which makes it kind of like a Lallybroch chapter. It's another rest and entertainment chapter.
Rosa R. writes, this title, she means I Am the Resurrection, is from John 11, verse 25. And very appropriate for the rest of the chapter. As we hear later on in the chapter, it continues, quote, the one who believes in me will live even though they die, unquote. And that, of course, seems to be what happens to old Mrs. Wilson. And she says, the first time she read this chapter, I missed that Diana uses the phrase, an icy breath of snow. The second time, I used the search function on my Kindle, and it turns out this is the first and only time she literally says breath of snow in the book. Interesting. I haven't checked that, so I cannot verify that, but I have no reason not to believe that if she checked that. I will take that as the truth. I will say that something happens later on in the book, which I'm not going to mention, and I don't know if it's a breath of snow and ashes, the whole thing, but the title of the book is, I believe, is used in full later on, if I'm not mistaken. But that's a discussion for a much later chapter or a much later episode. So we are given a date, dear friends. Now here, the date doesn't really seem to matter as far, because it's not a letter from anybody. It's not a dated, you know, document or anything. But what we could do for funsies before we go on is it's 1773, which means in the 20th century, it would be, not for, if they went back now, right, it would be 1971?
I think it was 200 and it's over 200 years. So it was like 202.
It was 202.
So,
but I'm saying, was it 202 back or 200?
We've already gone 202 back. So you have to go 202 forward. So that would put you at 1975.
So it's okay. So good. So in 1975, thank you for that quick math lesson. So in 1975, I'm going to use my computer's calculator here because I don't want to do any kind of math. 1975 minus 1918. Claire be 57.
Does she be?
That's just for math right now. I don't think. Excuse me?
I said, does she be?
She be. So the reason I did that is because, well, anyway, the reason I call it the date is because apparently that now it's what I do since we have multiple seasons from the show, especially after the 20 years after Voyager. That, and we have deleted tweets where they get rid of stuff. So I don't even know if they know their own timeline or they just don't like, they stopped trying or caring. I don't know. We just know that the show's timeline is not the most dependable. It is made up. I'm not saying it's fake. It's all fiction, but it is what they want it to be. In the book, it's not perfect. Diana has admitted there are mistakes, but we can at least for within one chapter, you know, determine someone's age. I only mention that not because Diana cares for us to talk about it, but it comes up in this chapter later on. So I wanted to have done the math on my own, on our own, to be able to say, pull out a number. Okay. When I looked through the chapter and I realized what it was, I thought, oh my gosh, it's that chapter. This is a good one. If this is your first time reading, it's sad. It's sad what happens, but it's sad any time I think someone passes. I will say, and this might be in my notes later on, but I'll say it again later on maybe. It is one that I would, although I typically, when I take notes, I take it from the ebook. But if I'm trying to just listen to something for fun, for enjoyment, I will, as I said, listen. I will listen to Divina. This is one of those chapters where if you have an option, don't listen to it. I am very aurally sensitive, noise sensitive, all that. When Davina does her, I can't. Like, I have to stop it. I can't listen. So, good on you.
Oh, yeah. I totally read this. I didn't listen to this chapter.
Oh, Summer. No. You would have shot yourself in the head. It's in the ear. It's bad.
I mean, no. I can only imagine what it sounded like because in my brain it's laughing. I
mean, she does a good job. Don't get me wrong, but
I was laughing because of how ridiculous it was sounding. Because she described it as a bat fart.
Bat fart. I know that was great. But Davina did not. The sound that the girl made did not, or Davina made. Did
how
not
do you know? Like have fart. You heard a bat fart?
Not that we know what a bat exactly. fart sounds like. I just said we don't know.
Someone does. Someone knows.
So we get Roger being called for his minister connections in the last chapter. Roger and Bree and the family are asleep, meaning their family, when someone bangs on their door before dawn. It is Hiram Crombie, whose mother-in-law passed away the night before, and would he, Roger, come say a few words over the grave? They'll start digging after breakfast. I get it, no embalming at that point, but wow, this was fast. But it makes sense, they wanted her in the ground before the snow came, and probably, maybe not right when the snow came, but in a few weeks, which they wouldn't wait anyway, at some point the ground would probably freeze, which I don't think they'd wait that long, but it was pretty quick, but I get it.
And apparently Hiram didn't care much for his mother-in-law.
Rosa R. writes, it turns out Murdo Lindsay has recommended Roger to Mr. Crombie. At this point in the chapter, I wondered whether Roger even considered saying no to Mr. Crombie. It is clear that, unlike in the show, Roger's throat still makes public speaking quite an ordeal. So the reason that she mentions Murdo Lindsay, and that's from the chapter, is that Roger had spoken at the grave of, what was the name they gave the dude? The Hiram Crombie's potential relative among the natives. And while they were there burying them, Roger spoke some words over the grave. So Murdo Lindsay is the one who recommended Roger to Mr. Crombie. Rosa R. continues, when Mr. Crombie has left, after asking them that, Roger and Bree discuss old Mrs. Wilson's, who only recently traveled from Scotland to the New World. In this scene, I feel Diana is trying to tell us more about how Roger and Bree feel about their own time travels. But this conversation feels very different from the show, the way Bree and Roger discuss Mrs. Wilson's story. Travel from Scotland to the New World seems to be a metaphor for travel from the 20th to the 18th century. In the show, when Bree and Roger first discussed leaving the Ridge to go back to the future, we got the impression that Bree wanted to stay because her family was in the 18th century. But in this conversation about Mrs. Wilson, it feels like Roger is the one who emphasizes having family around you is important, while Bree does not like the idea of dying in a strange place. The final, and this is their conversation, is what Rosa means. The final of this conversation does not make clear to me whether Bree completely agrees with Roger. So Bree isn't buying it that the women there at Crombie's house would be preparing and working by candlelight, since Hiram is so tight-fisted. She says that he would never allow them to work by candlelight because he's not going to give them candles. She thinks Hiram was, quote, trying to get under your skin about your wife being a lazy slattern, unquote. And then Jim asks, what's a slattern? They have a little fun with that, but he says, Roger answers him, it's a lady who's no lady. So their plan is they will all go pay their respects. And Roger thinks that Jem has not seen a dead person yet, although he's been hunting. So he knows about death in general, just not with humans, I guess, or hasn't seen one. And before they can leave, they'll have to go up to the big house to get a Bible. So it's Roger who tells them of the death, meaning Claire and Jamie. So Claire is curious of what Mrs. Wilson died of. There's a good bit of conversation, like a few paragraphs, if I'm not mistaken, about how young Claire looks for her age, especially when compared with her contemporaries in the 18th century. And this is why, and Rosa mentions it a little bit later, but that's why I wanted to do a little bit of math. So she's approximately 57. And Mrs. Bug has made a basket with food for them to take to the family. Now, Roger is looking over the Bible to figure out what he'll say. Bree notices Jamie's got the Bible he has that he got from Jamie. He has a Protestant Bible. And they tried to offer Roger a dram in his coffee, something alcoholic, you know, for his voice. Diana writes, he was worried about his voice himself. He didn't need solicitude from the redheaded contingent, all three of whom were giving him thoughtful looks that he interpreted as casting extreme doubt upon his speaking abilities, unquote. So trying to get some content, he asks widely now, does anyone know anything about old Mrs. Wilson? He's like trying to get information about her. And Jimmy pipes in, she's dead. Well, that's helpful. Also, and this was the point that was made, or the point that I guess Diana was trying to make, that we it's mentioned that this is a Protestant Bible, and they confirm it. It's a King James Version. And Jamie said it was the Bible he had in prison. It's what he had.
He said it was given to me.
Yes, it was given to him in prison, but then he had it while he was in prison. So we're not told exactly here in this book, or at least here in this chapter, what it is. But because it was Protestant and it was given to him, I believe we're to believe
it's Alex's.
This is the Bible he was given from when he was in prison after being whipped by BJR for the first time. Yeah, I think it's Alex. I forget Alex's last name, but I think it's Alex's. Yeah. That's what my guess is. Rosa R. writes, it is clear from Claire and Roger's conversation that Roger has not quite figured out how to judge a lady's age in the 18th century. We know, of course, that Claire, coming from the future and having taken good care of her health in both times, looks much younger than her 50-something women, than other 50-something women in the 18th century. But if Mrs. Wilson was 5 years older than Claire, that means Mrs. Wilson was in her late 50s, actually early mid-60s, now that we know Claire's age. Quote, at least 80, unquote. Indeed. Poor Claire, of course, feels a bit insulted. If only she could read Roger's mind, as he is very complimentary on her looks later on. On the other hand, maybe it's a good thing she couldn't hear him describing her as more than handsome, elegant, with startling eyes. A bit much when you're thinking of your mother-in-law.
But he does all the time. He always has inappropriate thoughts about Claire. He always says things that are inappropriate about her.
They come across the... I'm going to butcher the Gaelic, y'all. I'll do my best. They come across the bantrem. 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 Something like that. It's the professional mourning women. Well, one profi and one apprentice. Well, Jamie goes and introduces himself to them, and we find out it's a Mrs. Guilty and her niece. And Jamie tells them they're doing very well. Mrs. Guilty isn't so convinced. Quote, a voice like a bat farting, but she's the only woman left of my family, and I shall not live forever.
Wow.
Unquote. That was a really
good.
Did
you by chance really good Google line. Bat farting? I wonder if you could Google it.
No, did you?
I'm just, you usually Google stuff. You. Sure, if it was a tree, you would have looked for the symbolism, but you won't look up bat fart?
Nah.
Hateful.
I kind of don't do trees too much. I don't do a lot
just
of
just hateful.
Rosa R. writes, this chapter is full of Scottish traditions around death. In Valerie Estelle Frankel's book, The Symbolism and Sources of Outlander, I found a section on all of the different rituals described here. The bantrim, the sin eater, the graveyard watch for the last person to be put to rest there, even the tradition for a young bride to sew her own shroud. A lot of this section was available for viewing on Google Books when I tried it. That's very cool.
Some mornings you wake up feeling ready to pull the covers over your head and go back to sleep. No judgment, of course, but let's make having the most comfortable sheets in the world the reason why. Don't love your sheets? Brooklinen has you covered.
Brooklinen was started by Rich and Vicky, who also tried to find beautiful home essentials that didn't cost an arm and a leg. And when they couldn't, they founded Brooklinen as the first direct-to-consumer bedding company.
They work directly with manufacturers to make luxury available directly to you without the luxury level markups. Brooklinen has a variety of sheets, colors, patterns, and materials to fit your needs and tastes.
Brooklinen has over 50,000 five-star reviews and counting. They are so confident you will love their products. They even offer a 365-day money-back guarantee. And Brooklinen is so much more than sheets. They've got comforters, pillows, towels, even loungewear, and more.
And while they do have more, can we talk about those sheets for a second? I'm still rocking my first set of Brooklinen sheets. They are white with a very thin, like charcoal gray pinstripe, and they go perfectly with everything else in my room. And I still, to this day, how many years on, am looking forward every night to climbing in bed to go rub up against those buttery sheets.
And I went with a full everything, the set, the duvet cover, the pillow shams, everything. I went for white everywhere because I already had a color scheme that I liked, but I had white as kind of a neutral-ish, white and gray for like a neutral in my bedroom. And it goes with any sheets or any kind of duvet set that I already have. And I still love the sheets. Yes, I love the look, but also, yeah, they're, as Summer said, they are buttery.
So go to brooklinen.com and use promo code Outlander to get $25 off when you spend $100 or more, plus free shipping.
That's brooklinen.com and enter promo code Outlander to get $25 off when you spend $100 or more, plus free shipping.
That's brooklinen.com and use promo code Outlander at checkout.
So everyone is there for Mrs. Wilson's wake slash burial, right? That's why they're gathering here. But as they are making their way to the house, they are meeting up with other people, and they talk about different things. And they're talking about other people who are sick. And there's and Claire, of course, the doctor, like, she can't help someone who's dead. Like, that's done. That horse has
or
left
can
the,
she?
Train has left the station. Put it that way.
But yeah. Has it?
So, but when she hears someone sick, she feels bad. She feels bad. Like, oh, that's something I could do. And this is kind of the harder part for her. It's not that she doesn't love that people hate her or are afraid of her. She doesn't love it. But the hard thing for her to accept is that because of what they might feel for her or about her, no one's coming to her to let them know that they or their loved ones are sick. So people could be definitely suffering, if not dying, right? Because of their feelings for her, however ill-placed or whatever reason. And so Claire's concerned about this, but this conversation about people who are sick and people who are dead or dying gives Diana the opportunity to tell us about the graveyard myth. This is that the last person buried in a graveyard must stand watch over it. And Jamie explains this to Claire, until another comes to take his place. And then the Bantarim are off again practicing. And I think that's where it's god awful. In the text. Yeah. When it's just words, it's not so bad. But when it's like, ah, ooh, ee, whatever, when it's like just like long letters or like gobbledygook nonsense, that's what's bad when Davina does it. I can't listen to it. So they get to the cabin and they see there are no windows in the cabin. And it's full of people. Mrs. Crombie is wrapped in the shroud that she likely made as a new bride. Now, Jemmy is asking questions. Quote, is that the dead lady, Grandma? Unquote. Jamie and Jem pay their respects, and Jem points at the bread that's on her chest, and said, what's that for? Is she going to eat it? So, yeah. And then he's told not the reason behind, not explained to him what it is, because that would be, you know, that would be a bit, but he's told, no, that bread, that's for the sin eater. Meanwhile, as they're getting ready for the funeral, or the whatever it is, Claire's already thinking about going to find this Seamus Buchan, who was the dude who was sick. She's like thinking of how she can go find him or making an excuse or how to find him. And she wants to go heal him. And then Mrs. Bug comes in with Arch and they bring whiskey to Jamie, who'd forgotten it. And then it's ready to start and Roger begins talking. Rosa R. writes, finally, in this section, I felt that choosing to describe Roger's service from Claire's point of view was an interesting choice. Through Claire, Diana describes in detail what is physically wrong with Roger's speech. Huh, that's true. It brought home to me that Roger's troubles with speaking aren't all in his head. As I think you talked about in the podcast before, there's definitely a lot more going on. I feel it seems like it will be impossible to do this scene in the show, as Roger has all but gotten over his troubles with his throat. Thank you, Rosa. You are right. He has. In the show. I'm not bitter, just a little.
Well, it would have been a lot less interesting if it was told from Roger's point of view, because he doesn't have all those terms. So he'd have just been like, I had phlegm in my throat. It burned when I talked. My eyes were watering. You know what I mean? It's like.
It hurt on the lower right? Left side. Yes.
It would have been much less interesting.
While he's talking. Completely. While he's talking, Jemmy is pulling on Bree's skirt to get her attention. And then he goes over, or he turns, and he tries to get Claire's attention. And just as Roger is reading, I am the resurrection and the life, they see that Mrs. Crombie's eyes had opened.
Yeah, and Jemmy's the one who was like, Granny! Granny!
Yeah, I don't know if we have anything from this. We obviously don't have Roger's vocal problems any longer, which is not proof, you guys, don't freak out. But if you aren't going to worry about having anything past a season 6 or 7, but specifically past a 7, you don't worry about Roger's voice. I'll put it that way. So I'm not saying this is proof of anything either way, but and I know what we heard was that it would be too difficult for the actor to sustain. That's not up to me. I'm not the actor. I don't know. Maybe it would have been. Who knows? It's just that is arc related. So that is a loss, but we go on. So her eyes had opened and I wrote, "Well done, Roger Mack. You are effective." Roger helps pull her up and Claire goes to her to assess the sitch. Claire assesses that she has an aortic aneurysm and that she will die for real very soon, or again, however you look at it. Roger goes with it. Quote, "This, our sister, has been restored to life, as we all shall be one day by the grace of God." Unquote. And he asks her if there's anything she wants to say. She asks, "What sort of wake is this, Hiram Crombie?" So that's funny. And what I meant, which I did not finish my statement, which is that never happens ever. My reason is I didn't mean to harp on Roger's voice thing, but while we may not get the vocal thing, which we don't necessarily need to make this chapter funny, right? Or poignant. This, to a lesser extent, admittedly, than the two naked women getting all up in Jamie's junk at Snowbird Village, that is gold. Like, that's comedy and TV and visual gold. This is also gold, but I would, if we could only have one, I'd choose the former, right? But this is also like, oh my gosh, like such an opportunity, such an opportunity. If we don't get it, we don't get it. It's okay. But it would be, we don't need Roger to have a voice or not have a voice for this. Well, he needs to be able to speak, but he doesn't have to have an injured voice for this. So that doesn't affect us here, but it would be amazing if we could get this because it's so stinking funny. It's great. You know, it gives Jemmy stuff. It gives Roger an opportunity to speak. The old lady, Hiram, the Banshee, not the Banshee, well, the Bantadim, all those people. So anyway, it's hecka funny, I thought. Rosa shares with us a description of an abdominal aortic aneurysm. Quote, "In most cases, an AAA causes no noticeable symptoms. However, if it becomes large, some people may develop a pain or a pulsating feeling in their abdomen. An AAA doesn't usually pose a serious threat to health, but there's a risk that a larger aneurysm could burst. A ruptured aneurysm can cause massive internal bleeding, which is usually fatal. Around 8 out of 10 people with a rupture either die before they reach a hospital or don't survive surgery. The most common symptom of a ruptured aortic aneurysm is sudden and severe pain in the abdomen." And she provides a link for that. So they're just trying to basically soothe her until she blows her last gasket. But Mrs. Wilson continues. She can't let it go. Because of this back and forth, which I did not write out, but this back and forth between her and Hiram, like, how, where's the food, where's the layout, this is not a wake, what do you do, like, she goes for the jugular and she's about to go meet her maker. So I mean, respect, but also, oh Lord. So she continues this. Oh my gosh,
what would you do if you woke up in a room in a dark room surrounded by everyone, you know, you realize what's happening, and then you realize the cheapskate that your son-in-law is, that you're not even being given like a proper farewell. But also, how awesome is it that everyone gets a chance to literally say nice things to her that they might have thought to say? Now, I'm not saying they did. I'm not saying they did say the nice things, but they had the opportunity to be like, you know, I didn't think about this when you died so suddenly, but when you died, I had all these feelings, and now I, you know, I wish I'd told you more how much I loved you, which was so nice when she does finally go, that her last things were, "I forgive you." And she would never have had that opportunity.
I agree. The reason I laughed when you said that is, even though you didn't say these words, what I wanted to interject with was, the first time you died, I didn't have a chance to tell you these things. But now I do.
Exactly.
And you're going to
go
again.
It happened so suddenly.
Oh, Lord. She continues, quote, "I never thought I should live to see papists kinder than my ain kin." unquote. So that made me laugh. So yelling and name calling grow, and Roger takes a hold of the dying woman and centers her mind on what's to come. He reminds her that she stands before God soon, and then she fixates on what, on where the Sin Eater is. And then the dude arrives, a freaky looking man who doesn't look well. Like, he looks like he's been in an accident. His spine's all twisted. He looks wrong. He looks like he's been ill or injured for a long time. And she insists on him doing his work before she dies again. So he does, and then he leaves. Rosa R. writes, "The way Claire described the remainder of the events in Mrs. Wilson's life felt part dark comedy, with Mrs. Wilson's angry words from Hiram, for Hiram Crombie. Again, Claire is not fazed at all. She comments on the ugly brooch, thinking that Mrs. Wilson breathes, quote, like a steam engine. And then she also looked up Sin Eater for us. And this is what she found. Quote, a sin eater is a person who consumes a ritual meal in order to spiritually take on the sins of a deceased person. The food was believed to absorb the sins of a recently dead person, thus absolving the soul of the person. Sin eaters, as a consequence, carry the sins of all people whose sins they had eaten. Cultural anthropologists and folklorists classify sin eaters as a form of ritual. Sin eating as a form of ritual. It is most commonly associated with Wales, English counties bordering Wales, and Welsh culture.
But do they all, are they required to run out of the room like Nosferatu?
I have no idea. That's funny. I have no idea.
Because
I haven't read.
Flees. He flees from that cabin like a creature of the night.
Well, he usually is not there, like, having to perform for his actual client. His client's gone. Or the dead person is gone. Interestingly, Rosa continues, some of the authors who had written about the custom think it is popish. In 1838, Catherine Sinclair, a Scottish novelist, wrote that, quote, a strange popish custom prevailed in Monmouthshire and other western counties until recently. Many funerals were attended by a professed sin eater, hired to take upon him the sins of the deceased. By swallowing bread and beer with the suitable ceremony before the corpse, he was supposed to free it from every penalty for past offenses, appropriating the punishment to himself. Men who undertook so daring an imposture must all have been infidels, willing, apparently like Esau, to sell their birthright for a mess of pottage. And Diana's description of the Sin Eater through the otherwise so down-to-earth Claire makes him almost an otherworldly creature. In Frankel's book, she writes that the Sin Eater, quote, like many other characters and events in the series, adds a touch of the fantastical to the everyday, emphasizing the mystical world of the inexplicable, unquote. And I couldn't agree more. And so Claire, monitoring Mrs. Wilson, feels the hemorrhaging begin and feels as Mrs. Wilson dies and feels herself, Claire, being taken down with it. She experiences a loss of vision and a few other things, and Jamie asks her if everything is okay. Now, as they make their way outside, she says, yes, everything is all right now.
And that was chapter 39 and the end of part 5. Join us next time when we will be discussing we will be continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along, beginning part 6, On the Mountain, with chapters 40, entitled Bird Spring, and 41, entitled The Gunsmith. And as always, if you'd like to join us to continue the conversation, please come join us online in our online group at www.outlanderpod.com/group.
And a special thanks to this episode's co-producer, Courtney G. To find out more about how you can support us on Patreon, visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon.
And if you're interested in finding out more about any Outlander Pod branded merchandise, you can go to www.outlanderpod.com/shop.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us.
Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.